Case number 19-2371 and 19-2421, Cisco Grand Rapids LLC versus NLRB. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Carter, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court. This is a case where the National Labor Relations Board has imposed special remedies on the company that simply go too far and constitute remedial overreach. First, the violations it found are not related to the remedies it desires to impose. And second, those remedies are punitive and not remedial make-whole relief. When this case was presented, the National Labor Relations Board sought a Gissel bargaining order.
Mr. Carter, just a couple, this has been going on for a long time. Just a couple things I'm curious about. Is Mr. Brewster back at the company?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but he declined the offer of reinstatement.
And has there been an election since all of this happened? What's going on in terms of that? Is there an election scheduled?
No, Your Honor. There is not been a petition for an election filed by the labor organization, the intervener, or another union. And the issue of the case has stayed essentially with the NLRB pending resolution of this petition for review by the court.
So nothing's happened to moot some of these disputes. I guess that's what I'm really getting at, to try to figure out if each component of the order is still live when it comes to your client's perspective.
Well, Your Honor, there have been relevant developments. The intervener has filed over a dozen unfair labor practice charges against the employer since the events that are the subject of this case. And the National Labor Relations Board has not found any of those allegations to be meritorious. There has been, the company has not violated the act in nearly 5 years. Yet the NLRB still asked this court to determine that the employer is possessed now of a proclivity to violate the act in the future, which is not logical. It doesn't make sense. And it's directly relevant to their request for a special remedy of a broad order, because in order—
What's your response on the special remedy and whether we even have the authority to review it, given 29 USC 160E that says we can only review those, what is the exact language? No objection that has not been urged before the board shall be considered by the court. I guess two questions. The first question is, are you actually raising any type of extraordinary circumstances argument? Because that says this type of failure can be excused because of extraordinary circumstances. And if not, secondly, why do you think you preserved it adequately before the board?
Your Honor, we preserved the issues of the special remedies both before the NLRB as well as, or both in making exceptions to the administrative law judge's recommended order, as well as through a motion for reconsideration that was filed with the National Labor
Relations. I read the objections. I read the pages. It's essentially said you object to the entire remedy. Do you think that general objection should be deemed sufficient to raise any type of specific arguments in support of the general objection? Is that the theory, that as long as you say we object to the remedy, that preserves any conceivable theory for why the remedy was overbroad?
In paramateria with the motion for reconsideration, Your Honor, it's very clear that under Lew's Transportation, case law from this circuit, Judge Cook, you were on that panel. In that case, the court made it clear that where a party preserves an argument with regard to a decision of the board so as to put the board on notice, even in a motion for reconsideration, they preserve the argument under Section 10E of the Act. And that's even more clear because the court in Lew's Transportation was relying upon U.S. Supreme Court precedent that held similarly. There's no need for an extraordinary circumstance in our argument.
And the board even consider, so you raise a First Amendment challenge to the remedy. I'm curious whether the agency has the authority to resolve First Amendment type. Lots of administrative agencies have limits on their constitution, on their authority to answer constitutional questions. With the board, if you raise the First Amendment claim and said your order violates the, or this order violates the First Amendment, would the NLRB be able to resolve, say, yeah, you're right, it does violate the First Amendment?
They certainly could write that, but this court would have de novo review over any constitutional determination that the agency had. What the agency more likely would do, and what they should have done in this case, is concluded that under Section 8C of the National Labor Relations Act, the employer was protected against compelled speech. And the compelled speech that was at issue and is at issue in this litigation involves a requirement that the employer stand idly by and silently by a board agent and a union agent in order to confess their sins, in order to be subjected to a process that violates the democratic principles of the dignity of man, as the Fifth Circuit concluded very
well. But the board's order did say either the president should read the notice, or if the president doesn't want to, a board official could read it. Where you're not content if having the board official read the notice, wouldn't that solve any concerns with the dignity of man?
No, Your Honor, and the Fifth Circuit so concluded in the Denton County case, which we recently provided you and which was issued subsequent to our reply brief.
So in that case, the board said you have to read this notice, or the board, somebody from the board, can they still found it problematic?
They found it unenforceable, Your Honor, because of the very strong concerns regarding democratic principles and the dignity of man, which is a very strong interest of the state.
Remind me, did they rely on the First Amendment or 8C?
They've simply found it, Your Honor, and a short look at the decision will illustrate this. They did not rely on the First Amendment. They did not rely on 8C. They found it unenforceable by virtue of how egregious it was. It is necessarily a degrading and humiliating experience, and is so by design. That's what the Fifth Circuit concluded. The other special remedies are not immune from your consideration either, Your Honors. One of the most, a common theme of two of the special remedies identified here, as I alluded to in the beginning of my argument, is the fact that in order for this court's jurisprudence establishes that it will enforce a special remedy where it is directly related to the violations found in the trial, and it's not punitive. And that's based on decades of jurisprudence from the U.S. Supreme Court and the other circuit courts. Succinctly said in Decaturville, which was cited by both parties as strong precedent, the Decaturville sportswear case, this court held that the board's remedy may not go beyond what is necessary to redress the injury done to the company's employees.
How about access to addresses? How does the law work on that? I mean, you certainly can understand why that's valuable to the union. You could understand it as a compensating device if they feel the company's not behaving fairly when it comes to the NLRA. What's your take on that one?
The Sixth Circuit take on that one, Your Honor, is that lists of employees' names are relevant to a union access violation, where the union has failed to get access to employees because of the employer's violations of the act. In Decaturville, there were many. Here, there were none. Nonetheless, in Decaturville, this court said that providing employee names and addresses to the union is not appropriate. It goes too far, and we will not enforce that because, one, it would put the union in a better position. Even though they had denied union access, the employer did with violence in that case.
Why would it put them in a better position? Wouldn't they be in the same position? Both sides would have access to the addresses of the employees?
The union would be in a better position if it had lists, especially every 6 months. And even then, the Sixth Circuit said, no, we're not going to provide it, also because of the employees' interests to be free from harassment at home and their right to privacy.
Okay.
Nonetheless, the board here ordered it every 6 months for a 2-year period requires the company to provide or to agree to that remedy.
Mr. Carter, your red light is on, so we'll hear from Mr. Lauro, and you'll get your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, and I hope you hear me today. I appreciate the court letting us appear by video today. I am Greg Lauro for the National Labor Relations Board, and I want to start with the Section 10E argument, if I may.
Can I ask an introductory question for that? So some of the older cases have called it jurisdictional. I'm not certain that that's the right way to think about it today, given the revolution in the nomenclature over jurisdiction. I don't think exhaustion is generally considered jurisdictional. And I wonder if the NLRB had a view on whether this 10E provision is jurisdictional, meaning we'd have a duty to recognize a failure to raise a claim with the NLRB, even if you didn't assert it on appeal.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that it is jurisdictional and that their failure to raise it means that under Section 10E, the court should not and cannot address it. And the reason I think they failed to preserve their claim is first, as I believe was already noted, their challenge at the exception stage was insufficient to put the board on notice of their specific claims.
Mr. Lauro, help me out, because maybe I'm misunderstanding the case, but here's why I wasn't inclined to agree with the forfeiture argument. At the ALJ level, a Giselle order is entered, or Giselle order, however it's pronounced, is entered. In going to the board, you're allowed to prioritize, it's triage, you're allowed to prioritize that is the problem. I wouldn't have thought there was this burden on you to say, you need to reverse the Giselle order. And by the way, when you do that, you can't make these mistakes. Because the whole point of the Giselle order is the union's there. I mean, the whole point is you don't even need unionization anymore. They're on the property. So what's puzzling to me is why they're not allowed to focus on that. And then if the board decides, okay, we're going to get rid of that, but we're now going to have these special remedies, why motion for reconsideration? That really seems like a pretty natural time. I'm not saying it's the only time, but it seems pretty natural in this context. What am I missing?
I think what my opponent's missing under Section 10E is the importance of timely notice, that you make your arguments at the first available opportunity. And at the exception stage, my opponent could have said, we push for elimination of the bargaining order. And we feel that if that order is eliminated, it would have this impact, potentially invalidate these other special remedies that we know are in the judge's decision and that we know the board may adopt.
But aren't the special remedies irrelevant as long as there's a Giselle order?
I don't know if they're irrelevant if there's a Giselle order, but certainly they're not irrelevant in this case. Because if the board doesn't issue a Giselle order, the question becomes, how do you undo the impact of the violations and have a second election? The point being, under Section 10E, it's not just about giving notice, it's about giving timely notice. As we note in our brief,
Help me out. I'm sure that I'm clueless about this. The way I understood the Giselle order is you have to negotiate.
It's a bargaining order, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, so you have to negotiate. So the point isn't remedies that go to another election or bad conduct in the last election. The game is all about negotiate. And so those special remedies strike me as, I won't call them 100% irrelevant, but they just strike me as very much the tail on the dog. And it just seems very strange to me to talk about forfeiture with those tails when understandably they're focused on they don't have to be focused on it, but they won. And then they come in and say, here's the problem with these remaining special remedies.
Well, Your Honor, the other remedies are not moot or less important whether or not you have a Gissel order. These remedies, as the board explained, are mentioned to undo the harm on employees' rights to freely choose a union or not, or to exercise their support or not. And that's a distinct issue, a distinct harm that the board had to remedy. And I go back to the basic point here. At the exception stage, my opponent knew all of these special remedies are in play. And they could have said, if we knock this one out, here's why we think the other ones fall too, and they didn't. They didn't put the board on notice. And they certainly didn't put the board on notice of the particular claims they had. As we've discussed, they just said, other than challenging the Gissel order, we object to the ALJ's remedy in its entirety. The board did not have timely notice before issuing its decision that there would be these constitutional issues. Arguments under Section 302 and 8A2 of the Act, and other arguments that are being made. The point is, if you don't encourage parties to raise their arguments at the first available opportunity, you're encouraging delay, piecemeal.
And Judge, what's your answer to Judge Murphy's question about the board's authority to invalidate an order or a provision of the NLRA as enforced as violating the First Amendment?
I believe the board has authority to address a claim that a remedy or a finding of a violation under labor law would violate the First Amendment. The board can look at that.
Separate and apart from 8C or whatever it is.
Yes, Your Honor. And 8C, by and large, codifies the rights guaranteed under the First Amendment.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Assume that they did adequately preserve this. I guess the analogy I would draw, at least with respect to the fair access point, is the Supreme Court case that suggested it was unconstitutional to make a newspaper use its editorial pages to have responses to editorials that the paper puts out to the public. It's like kind of a tit for tat. The court said that the First Amendment does not allow you to come to take access to the newspaper's property, its pages, and give competing views to what the newspaper wants. I guess I do see some analogy between that case and here, where you're saying that you're compelling or allowing the union to come on the property of the employer and give speech that the employer vehemently disagrees with.
Well, Your Honor, that newspaper case, I apologize. Is that one that my opponent cited here?
It was just one that I had thought of.
Understood. I would first go back to the standard of review here, which is the court under precedent should affirm the board's remedy unless it's a patent attempt to achieve something the Act says the board shouldn't be trying to achieve. You look at the legitimate remedial purpose, and here the board had a legitimate remedial purpose. The employees' rights have been trampled by what I think we can agree is a pretty pervasive and unrelenting series of violations, capped by their regional president traveling to the facility to tell the employers there's more where that came from. I'm a rule breaker and I will violate the Act again to stop you from exercising your right to support a union. And the board explained why it felt the access remedy was appropriate, that its proper purpose was aimed at securing the union an opportunity to participate in the restoration of employees' rights, and that greater communication between the union and employees would dissipate the oppressive effects caused by Cisco's violations. Now, I'm just saying, under the law that applies to these remedies, the board made a reasonable choice that supported—
Do you agree that we give de novo, this is again, assuming it's preserved, but we would give de novo review to a First Amendment challenge?
You would give de novo review to a First Amendment challenge, though I would point out even a constitutional issue could be colored at the edges by labor law issues in which the board deserves some deference. In other words, explaining how you weigh these violations in terms of the need for a remedy.
I find that interesting because the Supreme Court has been adamant, so protective of the First Amendment, that it engages in de novo review. Even of trial court findings, that's the Bose case. It suggests that a trial court's findings an appellate court should review de novo to ensure adequate breathing space for the First Amendment. It would be strange to me to think that the NLRB gets more deference in terms of its fact-finding or at the edges than a district court would with respect to an Article III judge determining facts.
I didn't mean to confuse the issue, Your Honor. I simply meant to say, while acknowledging de novo review of a First Amendment issue, that at the same time, what's in play is that Congress charged the board with developing labor policy, and what comes with that is deference to labor issues. And there, you're looking at both a First Amendment issue and a labor law issue here. I guess what I would say.
What about with respect to the last issue in their brief, which is not with respect to the remedies, but with respect to whether some of the speech during the election violated 8C. Don't you think we should, the First Amendment would require us to give some type of de novo review to the board's findings about whether there was an adequate threat or whether that 8C test was met? It seems to me that there are serious First Amendment implications with respect to speech during an election.
Is Your Honor, are you referring to a particular statement that was found unlawful?
The first claim in the plaintiff or the employer's brief, which is concerned, I forget which official it was, but his prediction that customers would go elsewhere if you unionized.
Oh, no, I understand.
His experience.
I mean, the board has a standard approved by the Supreme Court in Gissel that employers are perfectly free to make predictions about the consequences of unionization as long as it's not made coercive by surrounding circumstances and it's phrased based on objective fact. Now, if you can bear with me, the court, like the board, assesses those statements in context. Statements that may be lawful or innocuous on their own can become unlawful and have negative effects in context. And what we emphasize in our brief, as did the board, is the context here. You have captive audience meetings around this time, replete with uncontested unlawful threats, warning, we may not really bargain, we may put nothing on the table, you could lose jobs. Some of these are very stark outside of the meeting, saying, oh, you two union supporters, you better hope the union gets in or you're going to be fired. Now, it's in that context, and employees are very aware of that when they hear these statements, that the gentleman in question says, yes, in my experience, some customers don't like union shops. And I feel that if you're unionized, you might not do things that are in your union contract. And that's a detrimental excuse to give a customer. But the concern here from the point of view of a reasonable employee is this employee is suggested through their uncontested violations that they may engage in reprisal if the employee uses unionization. And one thing they might do is just not put anything on the table and bargain. And we also see the threats that this could lead to strikes. And so in that context, they're saying, you guys are probably gonna do something as unionized employees that makes our customers unhappy. And they're ignoring any give and take that could happen with the union to avoid that problem and assuming it'll be so extensive that it'll lead to loss of customers and job loss. And the question is, where is the factual support for that claim? And I would also say that looking at it from the point of view of a reasonable employee, this would have a tendency to coerce. It does indicate.
Counsel, I should know this, but maybe you can just tell me quickly. I realize there's I know the forfeiture argument, how it's framed in front of us, but just remind me what the board did. So the board has in front of it this ALJ decision that issues some of these special remedies, has right. The Giselle order. Does it say after overturning the Giselle order, we're not even going to talk about these special remedies because the company hasn't challenged them? Or does it say, and the special remedies are okay too? What does it say?
It explains for each special remedy what the proper remedial purpose is, why it was justified by the severe unrelenting violations we have here.
Why isn't that pretty strong evidence that there wasn't a forfeiture? In other words, from its own perspective, it saw the general challenge to special remedies as requiring it to address each special remedy as opposed to something that said, listen, this has been forfeited. You can't preserve a challenge to special remedies with a general objection to remedies.
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. One is the mere fact that the board discussed an issue does not automatically mean the issue was preserved for appellate review or that every argument was preserved. As we were discussing—
Just to stop you there.
Yes.
I'm pretty confident if the board introduced an error, the company can challenge it. All right. That I'm pretty confident of. If they've introduced an error into the order, of course it can be challenged. And no one's supposed to be omniscient ahead of time and know the filings they're supposed to make in front of the board to anticipate an error they make. Right?
That's right. My concern, Your Honor, if I may, is with regard to this issue of timely notice that undergirds Section 10E. The board, although it discussed the special remedies and why it felt they were supported, which is something the agency should do, wasn't on notice of the particular claims that the company made in an untimely manner. The specific First Amendment challenges, very specific arguments about a thing of value under Section 302.
Well, what about this as an approach? You take a situation where there are some good explanations for exactly what was pushed at the board and what was not. But our court says, acknowledges your exact point. They may not have realized all of the components of the challenge. Let them look at those special remedies in the first instance and have an opportunity for a more fulsome decision. I get the point. In other words, they're getting taken advantage of because they don't have all the briefing on it. They issue an order that perhaps doesn't put the special remedies in the best light. And so but it seems to me the answer is to allow them put the special remedies in the best light, not this either we ignore them and we don't touch them at all or completely reverse them. Why isn't that a good answer?
I think it again goes back to the purpose of Section 10E. And the idea reminds me a bit of what you see in the Parkwood and Spectrum Kent cases we cited, because at the end of the Parkwood case, the D.C. Circuit anticipated what you just raised. It's a good question. And there it was a failure to challenge a bargaining order. The party, kind of like we have here, just said, remedy bad. I don't like the remedy as a whole and didn't say anything specific about the bargaining order in its exceptions.
Did the board go on to address the merits of the point in that case?
I believe so, because what the court said is essentially what you just said to the party in finding that it was jurisdictionally barred and couldn't be cured by untimely raising it in a motion for reconsideration. At the very end of the decision, the court says, we understand that you won't know the exact reasoning or contours at that time of how the board will support the Gissel order, but you know enough to tell the board why you think such an order shouldn't be issued. And your absolute failure to do that, just making a general claim, this remedy, that you know we challenge the whole judge's remedy, is not good enough. And it resulted in forfeiture. So I would just ask Your Honor to look at that case as an example.
Well, I think you're responding to my suggestion by just saying it's a complete forfeiture, which I, you know, good for you as a lawyer for your client, but it's not great for you in terms of answering my question. Do we not have authority to send it back to the board and say, listen, you gave a half-baked explanation for these special remedies. That wasn't 100% your fault. You obviously thought it was preserved. We think it was preserved in light of the Gissel order. But most importantly, we think it's helpful to have the board have a first shot at fully explaining. We have that power, don't we?
Your Honor, I'm not trying to be stubborn. I'm just saying
it depends. Assume we found that 10C is complied with, or 10E, whatever it is, that it's complied with. I get your jurisdictional point, not lost on me, believe me. So we say we have jurisdiction, it's either extraordinary circumstances, it was preserved, but at the same time we say better to let the board take another look at this because we think the justifications don't support the order as is, number one. Number two, there may be an explanation for that. It wasn't as fully briefed as the Gissel order was.
I understand what Your Honor is saying. It is true that if you find the remedial challenges before you, that they preserved it under Section 10E, I understand that, and you find there's something lacking in the board's rationale so that it's unenforceable, you could have the authority to send it back or remand it. But I'd be remiss if I didn't refer to the arguments in the brief showing that that's not necessary here, because each remedy is within the board's remedial discretion, and the board did give a satisfactory answer.
I got that.
No, I understand we're talking in hypotheticals, but I just wanted to reiterate that when you look at the severe violations we have here, capped by their senior official saying,
Believe me, I'm not going to say you engaged in a forfeiture. That's not what's going to happen.
I appreciate it. I just thought I'd better stand up for the remedies. I think on the merits, they're very well supported. And I know it can be tiresome to repeat the standard of review, but just within this idea that the remedy stands unless it's a patent attempt to achieve prohibited ends, that the board's remedial order should be affirmed.
Thank you.
And, you know, if the court has any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. One thing I should respond.
I can't remember. Ms. Mitchell, has the red light gone on? I can't remember. I think it has.
My apologies. So unless the court has more questions to keep me up here, I thank the court for its time.
Okay, Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I can deal with this issue fairly quickly because the court asked a very important question regarding how did the NLRB respond to this? What did the NLRB say with regard to the original exceptions that were posed by the employer, which were made, we accepted to the remedies? Here's how the court responded. If you go to petitioner's appendix, page 03, you'll see the NLRB write in its order, we shall further order additional remedies. Remedies that hadn't been ordered before or recommended by the administrative law judge. The NLRB wrote, finally, we amend certain remedies that were recommended by the judge. Your Honors, what that illustrates clearly is that the petitioner never had an opportunity to accept all the remedies because we had new remedies and we had amended remedies that we saw for the first time with the NLRB's order. So what did we do? We made a motion for reconsideration at the first opportunity to ask the NLRB, wait a minute, please don't issue these special remedies because they're inappropriate. They're not supported by law. You're going to get reversed because these are not supported by the violations found and they are punitive in nature, among other frailties with regard to the recommended remedies. That's what we're supposed to do. Under the law of this circuit, under the law of loose transportation, where the court wrote in an en banc ruling, we concluded that we lack jurisdiction to consider the question under Wolke, the controlling U.S. Supreme Court case, and 29 U.S.C. section 160E, because this specific issue was not raised before the board prior to its decision or, in italics, upon reconsideration. A motion for reconsideration is expressly anticipated in the Sixth Circuit to provide an opportunity to a litigant before the board in precisely this kind of circumstance.
I take it you don't have any precedent that says motion for reconsideration always suffices to comply with 10E.
Motion for reconsideration always suffices to comply with 10E. I don't have one that says always.
I wasn't aware of that precedent, and it would seem a little unusual. If you have 10E and you might make it arguably jurisdictional, it seems like a funny way to implement the regime.
Your Honor, our position is clearly that Section 10E is not jurisdictional. It is an issue that, as counsel described, whereby a party before the board has an obligation to put the board on notice with regard to an issue that it may challenge them upon in a petition for review. We did that. We did that for the motion for reconsideration. We did that with regard to the briefing in the motion for reconsideration. All of those representations put the board on notice that we would seek review, and we have sought review because the violations that the board found are not related to the remedies that were imposed. The court, I've asked the court to take a quick look at this issue. In the Decaturville sportswear case, the employer was far more egregious than the NLRB has alleged with regard to Cisco Grand Rapids. In that case, 17 employees were terminated. In that case, the employer centrally directed...
Mr. Carter, I don't know if this is a reflection of the dissipation of your time or your microphone, but we're not hearing you as well.
Oh, I apologize.
So maybe get closer or something. I'm not sure what's going on.
I apologize, Your Honor.
There you go. That's a lot better. That's good.
Right. Thank you. In that case, the board found that the employer had centrally directed a massive and violent campaign against the union organizing drive. Many of the unfair labor practices that the court or the board found involved the access of the union to the employees of the employer. In that case, the NLRB found that the employer threw ink or sprayed ink on the organizers, that they knocked leaflets out of their hands, that they drove organizers' cars off the road, that they had tomatoes thrown at them. Nothing like that's alleged here. But despite that, even with those claims, this court, the Sixth Circuit, refused to enforce the special remedy ordered by the board that employees' personal information be provided on one occasion, one time. Here, the board orders us to provide the union with the employee information every 6 months for a 2-year period. And there are no violations in that record that illustrate a denial of union access. In fact, the ALJ concluded that a majority of the employees had signed union authorization cards, demonstrating plainly that the union had the access to the employees in order to...
Mr. Carter, your red light's on. So thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Laura. We appreciate your briefs. It's a really complicated case, so it's great to have some experts on both sides. So we're really grateful for that. Thank you so much. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.
This honorable court is now adjourned.